Welcome to Ordinary Fellowship, a podcast inspired by the Puritan practice of godly conference, or spiritual conversations among believers. These spiritual conversations offer practical spiritual help for Christian living. I'm Jeremy Lee, and with me as always is Matthew McLaughlin.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hey. Today we have a special guest with us. He's been here before. You're our first returning, well, other than our pastor. But he's allowed to come back anytime he wants and say anything he wants.
So I'll feel privileged then.
Yeah. John Botkin is with us again. Last time you came and you discussed, well, we were online because we were still in the midst of the global pandemic.
That's right.
So you talked about gospel threads with us right before Christmas. So
yep.
I heard from several people that they were encouraged by that podcast. So
praise the Lord.
Hopefully this episode will be encouraging as well.
Amen.
Is there anything you'd like to tell us about yourself? I mean, I could say a few things, but...
I have four kids, one wife. A pastor right now at Providence Bible Fellowship in Westchester, Ohio. Specifically, I oversee our children's evangelism and missions ministries in addition to all the normal pastoral care and teaching leadership responsibilities. And happy to be back.
Good to have you. Let's get down to business. We're here to talk about the SBC meeting. As of the recording, it was last week, but it'll be 2 weeks when you're listening to this. A lot of controversy about it. But first, that just to let people know that may not be Southern Baptist, the Southern Baptist Convention is an association of churches who voluntarily cooperate together in order to advance evangelism, missions, and education. And there's some other things that the SBC does, but these are the main things. We unify around a confessional statement called the Baptist Faith and Message. That's our doctrine. Now, there's disagreement whether that should be prescriptive or descriptive of what Baptist believes. But we are unified around that document. That document defines where we're at theologically. It's a fairly conservative, theologically, document, and I'm thankful for that. You know, with all confessions, they're man-made and imperfect, but it's good and has helped us cooperate together for a long time. So the SBC also has, we have local associations where we meet together. Our associational missionary met with us not long ago and talked about associations, but we also have statewide conventions as well. And all of these are voluntary. We work together for the purpose of the Great Commission. Yeah. That's why some have adopted the name of Great Commission Baptist.
Yeah.
Just to get us started, why don't you tell us what the Southern Baptist Convention is? What is this meeting? Because
yeah.
It looked like you guys just went and took pictures of yourselves and went out to eat all week and said you were doing something
that's
important.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, actually, it used to be 3 days, and for economical reasons, they've cut it down to 2 days. So there used to be even more time for eating and pictures, but there's less now. Essentially, the Southern Baptist Convention only exists for 2 days every year when we are in session in our annual meeting. And this is more or less a business meeting where we hear reports on those entities that you mentioned, the International Mission Board, the North American Mission Board, our six seminaries, those groups of people that manage all of those things when we're not in session for those 2 days throughout the year. But you're hearing reports on them, and you're voting on business related to those things. So you are also able to ask questions and have them answered by those entity heads, which is pretty amazing, to be honest. I mean, you've got this past convention we had in recent times a record number of over 15,500 messengers that showed up. And every one of them was able to go to a microphone and ask a question of one of our seminary presidents or of any of our entities. So that's an amazing privilege that you don't see in many other, if not any other, denomination. So it's a great time both to have the voices of the churches heard, because we are a bottom-up denomination, not a top-down. And that was evident in a couple of things that our executive committee, which is the group that operates throughout the year when we're not in session, they had a couple of recommendations, and those were voted down by the Southern Baptist Messengers. And I think on the ones that were voted down, that there were good reasons to do that. So, and overwhelmingly so. And they were making a statement about several things, which we'll probably get into later. But so it's actually a pretty amazing time. I saw people that I've not seen in years, not seen since seminary. And so it's always a good time to catch up, and usually that happens either in the hallways or at meals.
Yeah. Facebook, my Facebook was flooded with people from here in Dayton that I know, and
yeah,
and other people around the country that I've met, like college and things like that, meeting in Nashville. So
yeah.
I know somebody made a motion to permanently have the SBC in Nashville. Was there any consideration given to that?
So several, depending on we're kind of getting into the weeds or insider baseball here, but depending on what kind of motion it is, sometimes it falls outside the purview of direct vote by the messenger.
Right,
so that would have been referred to a committee that organizes our time, place, location.
Okay.
So they're going to look at, I'm sure, all kinds of factors to determine whether or not that's viable.
I'm sure Nashville will love that, but,
yes, you have an influx of over 15,000 people looking for hotels, wanting to eat. I'm sure there was a massive boost to the local economy. That, not to mention the Johnny Cash Museum that got 60 of our bucks to go in and look around. So,
yeah, it's a good place for Southern Baptists to meet, I'm sure.
Well, we actually have offices there, so that's part of the reason that's the case. But yeah, the city actually handled this really well, so kudos to them.
Cool. I guess the only other thing before we talk about anything controversial is what were the highlights in your mind?
Some of the highlights, we had the night before the convention started, I think it was 64 international missionaries that were commissioned and sent out, with, representatives of their local churches there. That was a huge highlight. I think the general positivity of that meeting. There were controversial issues. There were impassioned emotions and discussion that was made, but people that would have disagreed on a vote were then in the hallway eating hot dogs together, or walking burritos or whatever, whatever the convention hall had. And there was just a general atmosphere of all of our churches are going to look different. They're going to do things differently. But to your point, we are all centered around and unified around this common statement, which has at its heart a concern that the name of Jesus Christ is made known both to our neighbors and among the nations. And so you very much feel like you are at a big family reunion at these meetings. And that was especially true here at Nashville.
That's really what it looks like when I see the pictures and things online, because I've never been to the SBC meeting. For many years, I wasn't a Southern Baptist. So now, even as a Southern Baptist, usually it's too far away, and getting off work is difficult.
So yep.
The privileges of being a pastor, you get to go.
Yeah, and we should say that to that end, and this is not going to be a negative statement on you, but to highlight other people. The vast majority of the people that go are not pastors.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of lay people that go that use their vacation time, and they'll add on those extra days in Nashville or wherever they're at. So we're very thankful for them as well that they go and that they make they take the time to use their vacation and other things to show up to those annual meetings and make their voices heard along with the many pastors and others that are there.
So, as far as I understand, these are like the top three things that I've heard concerns about, and I have concerns myself.
Sure.
Of course, critical race theory is something that has been argued about basically since last convention with Resolution 9.
Mm-hmm.
So CRT was a bit big hot-button issue, both in the presidential, not campaign, but choice of the president. That was a huge issue. And
you mean president of the convention?
Yes, president of the convention, yes. The other thing is I guess this isn't really three issues, but the sexual abuse in the churches and the way that the EC, the executive committee, handled or probably better mishandled these issues. And it seems like right before the convention, news came about several members of the executive committee, one of whom was running to be the president of the SBC, who seemed to block and hinder these investigations. So these issues were all talked about at the convention. CRT, there was actually a resolution. Mm-hmm. It didn't mention CRT, but it was clear it was aimed at those beliefs. What are your thoughts overall on that whole issue? I mean,
yeah,
we could spend all day on this. So if you can keep it like 5 minutes, and if Matthew has any comments, we can.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do think it's important for context, and we talked a little bit about this, earlier off. We're not really on air, but off recording, I guess we'll say. And that goes back to Resolution 9, which was passed in 2019. We did not meet in 2020 because of COVID. And so when we say the last convention, we mean back in 2019. And in that resolution, it was not – so we have something – again, more context here. We have something called the Resolutions Committee. So resolutions are non-binding affirmations that the convention makes from year to year. And some of those are good. Some of those are not good. You can look back in our history and see several – resolutions that nobody in the convention would affirm today. So that's part of the difficulty with these things is who is in the room voting? Do they understand what they're actually voting on? There was another issue that came, another resolution that was very spirited in debate, in large part because people had not read the entirety of the motion and didn't understand it. And once that happened, it was language was changed. That was the one on abortion. Not sure. I don't know if you saw it or not. But specifically, Resolution 9 from 2019 dealt with critical race theory. And essentially that resolution said, the Bible always trumps everything, but there could be helpful parts of this resolution to help us understand structural racism. I firmly believe that most of the people in the room had no idea what CRT was, but they were against racism. So this seemed like, oh, here is a helpful tool to help us better understand and put to death racism in our convention and in our country, and so it was approved. The problem,
and they wanted to go to lunch. I mean, they were voting before lunch, and it was really the debate was really getting long. So.
Yes, yes, that's certainly part of it as well. And some people like to pontificate at the microphones, whether we need to or not. But so that was passed, and that. That created a lot of controversy in its wake, as you well know, and many of the listeners may know as well. It was clear this year that people had gone home, they had done homework, they had talked to their pastors had done research, reading, and nobody was in favor of CRT. The Council of Presidents, which meets annually, issued a statement last November saying, CRT does not cohere with a biblical worldview, does not cohere with our statement of faith, the Baptist faith and message, and it's actually not helpful for understanding society and structures from a biblical perspective. So the actual resolution did not name critical race theory, but was meant to be broader than just critical race theory. So the language is that any theory that subverts biblical teaching that we would condemn. Now, some people quibbled with that. They argued with that. They said that was a political move, not to mention CRT. It could have been. I don't know. I didn't take it that way. It seemed to me that they were trying to broaden the net to say, if anything else comes up, whether that's intersectionality or whatever else, that we're just going to say no. If we're not going to endorse this, we're not going to utilize that if it does not cohere with a biblical worldview.
And I think the problem with naming it is there isn't one critical race theory. There are many critical race theories, and people can get you can get around it if you just name it.
Right, right.
But the way you deal with it is to state what they believe and say, this is what I oppose.
Right.
And while I think the resolution could have been stronger, as it is, it's a fairly good document.
I think so. And I think that the main point that was trying to be made with Resolution 9 was also made with this other resolution that was just passed, and forgive me, I don't know the number, but that was, we don't like racism, right? That was the whole reason why the CRT thing was put forward. I'm not sure there was a nefarious conspiracy. I think it was, hey, here's a bullet in our chamber that will help us put to death racism. That's just a bad bullet. So we're going to reject that bullet. But at the same time, we're affirming as Southern Baptists, especially Southern Baptists, given our history, we are not racist. We don't affirm racism. We don't promote racism. And we are hardcore about rooting it out wherever we find it.
Right. Right. You got any thoughts about that, Matthew?
I would say that the fundamental issue with Resolution 9 and Resolution 2 is, and having CRT involved, is what you guys were already talking about. It's just the simple fact that it becomes this boogeyman, that if we kill the boogeyman, then we're good. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to something you, Jeremy, and I have talked about really for a long time, is that people are seeking to argue about two different things using the same words. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the things we have to understand. And then, so like one of the challenges from the floor was there was this document that didn't get brought up that supposedly 1,300 Southern Baptists had signed. Well, 75% of the 1,300 signatures came from five churches. Hmm. So if we make it this concept a big deal, and then we can fight and talk about how it's bad. But when we do that, we completely miss the opportunity to have the conversation that another conversation that needs to be had, which is it's not enough to simply say because we passed a resolution in 1995 that said racism was bad, that means it no longer exists and it's gone and we don't have to talk about it anymore.
Yeah.
And so
unfortunately, I think some of the internet trolls and the discernment bloggers, which this is an ironic statement because they have no discernment. But
yes.
What happens in my view is there are people who really speak a lot about racial issues, and just by virtue of speaking about racial issues, they end up being proponents of CRT. Hmm. And that's obviously not helpful.
Correct.
Yeah.
I think this is important because what I'm seeing and hearing is that there's a lot of tension between African American congregations and predominantly white congregations. There's increasing distrust on both sides, and that's not healthy. There have been several prominent African American pastors leave the SBC for these reasons, and it's concerning because we have to work to earn that trust. I mean, yes, we've done things like the resolution in 1995, and we continue to make great resolutions dealing with race, and they're good, and we ought to do those things, but I think it comes from a misunderstanding of different cultures and not listening to African Americans and understanding their suffering, and then of course political issues get thrown into that,
right.
And like I said, it's misunderstanding on both sides.
Yeah.
I think our African American brothers, especially when they find out that many Southern Baptists voted for Donald Trump and they think that's the worst thing ever. And then white evangelicals, white Southern Baptists voted by and large for Trump and can't understand why anyone would vote for Biden.
Right.
And instead of talking with each other, we're just blasting each other with labels, and that's not good.
Yeah, and so I think to both your points, we have to continually speak to the issues that are happening, and we need, and in this issue of racial reconciliation, I do think that it's, at least for the foreseeable future, as someone who thought in high school, as a culture, we were really past this, and had high hopes for my kids, and now it's worse than I've ever seen it as a 44-year-old man.
Yeah.
We have to keep speaking about this, and to your, I think, really wise point, we have to be willing to listen. I don't know if you've read Shai Lin's new book about this, but you know, he talks about being in a predominantly white church, and even if we would say, and I think we meaning not just white, but even some black conservatives, the minute a black person is killed at the hands of police, that we should not immediately assume racism. I think, I don't want to speak for him, but I think he would probably say that too. But the problem is, it's not just that one person. We're looking at these things as an isolated issue. And oftentimes the black community is not looking at it as an isolated issue. It's looking at the next link in a very long chain. So that individual killing may not have been racially motivated, but it feels differently to them.
Right.
So to your point of understanding, listening, yeah, I think we have a long way to go in that.
Yeah.
And so having these new affirmations, that we are working for this, I think is helpful to our denomination.
I'm not convinced that the reason there's not much listening going on is because of what Robin DiAngelo calls white guilt.
Right,
there may be
right.
some of that, but that book is nutty. But but there are issues in talking.
Yeah.
I mean, just this is not something that I want to delve too deeply in, but just think about the whole kneeling for the national anthem that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I can look at this and understand from both sides why there's no discussion.
Yeah.
Because people who love America, whose family have died defending that flag, really get upset
mm-hmm.
when someone disrespects the flag, and all their guards are going to go up. They're not going to listen to anything that you have to say.
Right.
But then, on the other hand, you have people who see that flag as oppressing them for hundreds of years.
Right.
And this is just yet another form of oppression and don't have the same feeling about it. But you've got to get past your initial offense, which may be, I'm not choosing sides here.
Sure.
But you have to be able to get back past your initial offense to at least talk and listen to where other people are coming from.
Yeah. And I think that is most helpfully done one-on-one. So rather than getting on social media, rather than getting on Twitter and find your neighbor down the road who's going to have a different opinion
right.
and talk to them, help me understand why you think differently about this. I think you make more progress and be more willing to listen that way
on
both sides.
I'm the only white guy that works in my department at work. Everybody around me is either an immigrant or an African American. And I've talked to them about these kind of things, and none of these guys that work at a factory or believe in CRT or really have any clue what it is.
Mm.
So I don't have to argue with them about that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
'Cause they don't care or don't know what it is, but they do have concerns about racial issues, and they're always willing to talk to me about it. So it's been very instructive.
That's good.
To see from their vantage point what's happening. And you have to have ears to hear.
Yeah. I think one positive thing, there's a blog site called SBC Voices that's pretty helpful, I think, in general. There was a good guest post by a guy named Eric Vance, who's not a Southern Baptist. He was a guest at the convention, and he talked about really how much he was welcomed and how genuine that welcoming felt. And I think that that would be a good article for people to read if they are thinking more negative thoughts about the willingness of Southern Baptists to be diverse and embrace people that are not white.
I think the challenge for us is we have to learn how to walk and chew gum at the same time. There's a validity to fighting things that would go against the Baptist faith and message, that would go against Scripture. Fighting liberalism is a good thing. But you can't not deal with things that come up because you're too busy fighting liberalism. And so we have to strive to be conservatively, theologically accurate, and at the same time interact with people in a way that we can demonstrate to them what Southern Baptists look like, what we mean. Or to say in another way, we need to learn how to love God and love our neighbor at the same time. We can't pick one to the exclusion of the other. I think that's what happens sometimes. At least it gets characterized that way. Either you love God or you love your neighbor, but you can't love both. But the command is love God and love your neighbor.
Well, and I think the other thing that would help is to turn off the discernment loggers and stay off of Twitter.
This is true. we could have a talk about a thing that just came out on Twitter that basically put it like this. Twitter is incredibly liberal. To be blunt about it, there's a poll, Pew came out with a poll. The average Twitter user would be Democrat plus 15 if you get into politics. Or think it like this, Twitter is as liberal as Vermont. The majority of tweets put out by Twitter, it would be the second most liberal congressional district in the United States is Twitter. And 3% of Twitter users publish 92% of the tweets. So,
hold on, say that again.
3% of the people on Twitter publish 92% of the tweets. So if we're using Twitter as a barometer for what's going on in the world, instead of, like John said, talking to our neighbor, we're going to have a completely different outlook of what actually is happening in the world.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's part of, I think that's part of our problem. We think Twitter is real life, and it's far from actual life.
Yeah. I don't want to get too far off on this, but the wars that are going on Twitter don't reflect what's happening in the SBC, doesn't reflect what's happening in your local church. Predominantly, most people in the pews don't even know what's going on Twitter.
Right.
So that's a good thing.
Yes.
So let's talk now a little bit about the sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. It was obviously mishandled by the executive committee. And one of my concerns with some of the possible presidential candidates for the SBC is that some of them were involved in the mishandling of the sexual abuse. I don't know what the motivations are. It sounds like money and trying to protect the institution, which is typically what happens. Anyway, my concern was that one of the concerns I had was that we would elect someone who isn't concerned at all about dealing with this issue, yeah, honestly and with integrity.
Yeah.
So I don't know what your thoughts are as far as that, what happened at the convention in that regard.
Yeah, I think, president that we elect of the convention, typically a pastor, not always though, doesn't wield an incredible amount of authority on some of those things, but I think optically can make a big difference. So if you have someone who is associated with, at best, obfuscation of an investigation versus someone who is very willing and says, hey, if we got to take a black eye on this so we can do better, let's do that. I want to go with that guy, right? So one of the things that was really positive from the convention itself was a motion that was made for a independent third-party investigation, not just to the EC, but any willing church as well. So it would help us to see not just in these isolated areas where we've bungled it, but as a convention, are we safe are our churches and how well are we doing with preventing and reporting across the board? And so that motion went through overwhelmingly. Well, it wasn't even close on that vote. I mean, well into the 90%. And so I think that that says that our convention, particularly, again, that doesn't mean some leadership somewhere in the ether, but our churches are concerned for this issue, and they want to take it seriously, and they want to make sure that we do well in this area. So that was all very encouraging to me as a Southern Baptist.
I'm thankful that it's being pushed as well, because I think there's a lot of naivety in churches about this issue, because I read one thing, I read somewhere that, you know, these Sunday school classes are taught by grandmothers and mothers and fathers in the church, so it's the safest place in the world to be. Unfortunately, we know for a fact that not all the churches are a safe place.
Right. Yeah, and I, to your point, I think that we just historically have not thought well about this. And a great book that has come out in the last 10 years is called On Guard. And it goes through not just the shameful statistics, not among Southern Baptists, but just in general and in churches about abuse, but also gives a lot of very practical steps that can be taken. The other part of those practical steps is that it means increased volunteers and increased money. And that's another area where churches often struggle. Children's ministry is often seen as a lesser ministry. And, you know, as far as this podcast would go, I would just say, our kids are worth it, right?
Right.
It's worth you missing church once a month or whatever it is, in order to make sure there's three people and not just, a husband and a wife where one's going to cover for the other if abuse takes place. It's worth it. And it's not just an attitude of protection, but service to those parents. And to our Lord who said, let the children come to me, right? So
right.
If Jesus values children, who are we not to value children? And not just their faith and their theological education, but their safety as well.
And I know from personal experience that some of those mothers are involved with husbands who abuse girls and or boys. And the wife covers it up. The wife enables it.
Yeah.
I know someone who raped repeatedly his own daughter, was an elder in the church, Sunday school teacher. They weren't part of mega churches where supposedly there's anonymity. They were part of small local churches.
Terrible.
And I'm not saying that this happens everywhere, and probably in general the person who said that it's one of the safest places to be is probably right.
Yeah,
but you would be amazed if you went on a sexual registry, even in a small town. When I lived in Michigan, you know the small town I lived in.
Yeah,
there were people everywhere.
Oh yeah,
on the sexual predator registry. So even in small towns, even in rural areas, there are people that you need to be aware of.
And churches are, you know, to our credit, loving, kind, accepting of all kinds of people, and if we're not asking the hard questions, if we're not running background checks, then that can bite us in the butt, so to speak. You know, our willingness to love people can come back in difficult ways, as is the instance of this situation that you're referring to here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With the presidential election, the choice of president of the SBC. I'm pretty unfamiliar with Ed Litton. I looked up some things about him and have heard things from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of my chief concerns with him is there are videos of him online. I don't even want to call it preaching.
co-teaching
with his wife.
Yeah. Yep.
There has been a push from people like Beth Moore. They're pushing the envelope, at least when it comes to the position of the Baptist Faith and Message on female preachers, female pastors. And so probably the biggest concern I have with Mr. Litton or Pastor Litton is that he's co-teaching with his wife, at least on occasion. That seems to me to open the door wider. He's also been very supportive of Beth Moore, which I'm not saying that you need to belittle her and do some of the things that some people have done to her. You can disagree with her position without being a horrible human being. But I am quite concerned that this is yet another opening of the door and the camel's nose is starting to get in.
Sure.
And I've told some of my friends that I don't believe that Mr. Litton is liberal. I think he's a pragmatist. And and there's a lot of pragmatism in the SBC, and it's a huge problem. But we never deal with it for a variety of reasons. So what are your thoughts on that score?
Yeah. So I was completely unfamiliar with Ed before I went down there. Normally I would have done a little more research, but I had just come back from a week of teaching in Brazil. And so that occupied a lot of my time before I had 4 days to turn around and head out. So I'm not that familiar with him. But what I am familiar with, obviously, is what I've seen since he's been elected. So one of the things I will say straight out of the gate is that a lot of the like New York Times type people celebrated him as a moderate, as if somehow he was going to save our convention.
Which he denies.
He denies, and from people that know him well, they would say, yeah, he's not at all moderate, definitely not liberal.
And he actually said on CNN that there is no moderate wing of the SBC.
Yeah, what that means is, again, for historical context, moderates were those that would affirm a lot of the same things we would, but would, like, deny inerrancy. Okay? So, we might call that classically liberal. But within Southern Baptist life, they would have been self-identified as moderates. They would have still believed in the resurrection of Christ. Classic liberals don't, and we had a few of those teaching at some seminaries back in the 80s. So in that sense, Ed is not, from anything I can see, a liberal or even a moderate, but a conservative. He holds to inerrancy and all of the core tenets of the Christian life. It seems to me that the only time that him and his wife were together was in this series on Song of Solomon that he preached through. I don't know his motives, but if I were to guess, he wanted her involved to present something of a more quote-unquote balanced view of the song, particularly if he's teaching on complementarianism through that. You know, one of the big criticisms we've heard, even through Beth Moore's exiting of the SBC, was that complementarianism is bad because it produces bad fruit. I think that that's a bad argument,
right?
Because there's lots of things that have bad fruit associated with good things, and you cannot draw a causal line, even
right.
if there's correlation. My guess is he wanted to mitigate against that. So if I was going to teach complementarianism, yes, I would want to quote from women, my wife, whatever, that would say, hey, guess what? This is biblical, and it works amazingly. I'm happy, you know. Not that I'm oppressed. So that's my quick hot take on the little bit that I've seen on that. I could be completely wrong on that. I don't think, though, that with the idea of women preachers or women pastors is going to explode, in part because of a quote by Ed Litton saying women pastors and preachers don't cohere with what we see in the Bible. Now, how old is that? Is that his current? I don't know. But I don't think we're going to see him pushing for that anytime soon.
Right. And that's not necessarily what I was saying.
I just,
the optics of it make it seem like this is acceptable for this to happen.
Yeah.
And even, I agree that you need to make sure that you're listening to women's voices, but the duty of preaching,
right,
is for a pastor or an elder,
yep,
and the Bible requires that they be men.
Right.
And
I agree with that. Yep.
And to me, it looked like a fireside chat when they were sitting up there, and
right,
that bothers me as well. But
right. And yeah, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly. I would not, first of all, my wife would never get on the platform with me because she would like, no way. Yeah, I have a view of preaching that says I am there to herald truth. I'm not there to engage in a dialogue and a conversation. I think you would,
amen.
would agree with that. So I'm not saying that I necessarily agree or endorse what Ed did. What I'm saying is I'm not sure all of the heat that he's taking for that is necessarily deserved because it may not mean what they think it means.
I think part of it is back to the conversation, the episode we had with Beth Moore, when we kind of talked about it a little bit. It goes back to how you interpret complementarianism, broad versus narrow. And I think that's part of the challenge. And I think just listening to his press conference after he got elected, I think you could reasonably make the argument that he would have a broader definition of complementarian than Jeremy and I would probably have, probably John too. That doesn't change the fact he's still complementarian. It's not like he's jumping into the egalitarian box. And so it goes back to degrees. And frankly, we've lost the ability to understand nuance.
Right, because most of our conversation is on Twitter or
right,
discernment bloggers.
Right, which, yeah, you can't do nuance on Twitter.
Just to give you an example, when I looked up Ed Litton, one of the things that came, and Matthew brought this up, one of the things that came up is the church's doctrinal statement about the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at this discernment blogger, not because I really cared about their opinion, but because
right,
I knew they would have a picture of the old statement.
Sure.
So what happened is the statement was pointed out as heretical. It really was. It was bad.
The last sentence of the statement.
Yes.
Yeah.
The last sentence of the statement was really bad.
Yeah.
The church changed it in response to that. So now it's the discernment blogger didn't change his mind about Ed Litton. He's still a heretic. He's just a deceptive heretic now.
Yeah. and the thing is, I agree that final sentence was horrendous, but I could also see where they were trying to say something true. And they just weren't using accurate historic language. It was a sloppy statement rather than an intentionally heretical statement.
Right. And in order for it to actually count as heresy, it has to be intentional. It can't just be accidentally saying something.
And you know, to their credit, you're exactly right that it was pointed out, hey, this is not clear language. And they said, oh, we made a mistake. Let's
right,
lean into that first part, which was clearly orthodox. And they just took out that last
right,
statement, you know, so.
And that's the way discernment bloggers are. That if you do something wrong and then change it, well, you scrubbed your site.
Right. Right.
Not, well, they saw the error of their ways and they
yes,
decided to change it. That, no, they're just deceptive heretics now.
Yeah.
So that's why these guys, I just avoid them because they're not helpful at all. They may occasionally stumble onto some truth, but it's not worth wading through all the garbage, the
right,
slander that goes on constantly on these sites.
Well, and even sometimes good people, I mean, this goes back to, you know, to what you said, brother, about, you know, chewing gum and walking at the same time. Even guys that I would admire and I would, you know, join arms with and be thankful for, sometimes miss the mark because they're aiming at the wrong thing, you know? And so, a really bad review of Ortland's book, Gentle and Lowly, that totally missed the point, right? I'm not going to condemn that whole ministry for that. But there is a, in my mind, anyway, I don't know how you feel about that, but an example of, you kind of missed the point.
We're in agreement.
Yeah, this book is not saying what you think it says or want it to say, and you're so used to defending the truth, I think, you missed the nuance of what this book was trying to say, which I hope you would agree with, you know.
Yeah, well, that ministry handed that book out at one of their conferences. So.
They did do that. I think,
and then said, oops.
I think one of the ways for us to understand what this part of the conversation is, it goes back to what we were talking about before. A sloppy statement comes, I think, it came as a result of pragmatism, not as a result of heresy. I think they were seeking to communicate truth in a way that people understand.
A very difficult.
Right. And let's be honest, you and I were talking about this Sunday. Lots of people get lots of stuff about the Trinity wrong because it's difficult and it's hard. And so it becomes a pragmatic problem, not a heretical problem. But this leads to the last thing for us to talk about. So I read another review from the president of the Oklahoma Baptist, and his basic argument is this a little bit inside baseball, but he said there is a drift inside the SBC, but it's not a drift toward liberalism, which was the charge before the convention started. It's a drift toward fundamentalism, which is something Jamie and I know plenty about. And I think that's one of the things, that's another thing we have to be aware of, is that the natural tendency is for us to run towards either liberalism or fundamentalism. So fundamentalism being the idea of, I'm going to set the rules, here are the rules, hold to these rules, or else I'm going to tell you why you're wrong. And no ability to have differing opinions. Now, bluntly, it's a whole lot easier to be fundamentalist than it is to let differing opinions get involved. But it's not the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
And I think that's the challenge. But my last thing is, bluntly, I don't think it does us well to spend all of our time looking at all the horrible, terrible stuff. Because what ends up happening is all the blogs and all the discernment and all the stuff, we spend all of our time talking about the business meeting on Tuesday, when the most important thing that happens, what John already mentioned, the most important thing that happened at the SBC was Monday night. That was the most important thing. There's this picture, if you go online and see to find it, there's this picture of this mom standing in the back with her kids on the platform behind a screen because her kids, her daughter and her son-in-law, are going to a restricted access country. And she's standing there crying as they're being commissioned to go off and preach the gospel in a place that if anybody finds out that they're coming to preach the gospel, they're going to be in prison and possibly killed. But they believe in the Great Commission enough that they're willing to give their lives because Jesus matters. And I think that's what we need to focus on, not on whether or not we're down to the nth degree, technically, theologically right. To the point that, well, we didn't put three letters in a resolution, so therefore we're just, you know, completely liberals, and we might as well just all quit and go start our own, go get on our boat and go start a new thing. I think that's one of the things, the challenge. That's, for me, was the takeaway, was Monday night, and to focus on Monday night, and to focus on the importance of the Great Commission, and focus on the task at hand, because I think if we're honest, we're getting lulled to sleep. And we're focusing on stuff, and people are dying, and the world is falling apart, and we're too busy trying to make sure everything looks pretty when the foundation is crumbling.
And I know you don't disagree with this, but we can do both.
Yes.
We can have these conversations and focus right on doctrinal stuff, but we also have to focus on the mission.
Right.
The message is important, but so is the mission. And we've got to do well at both.
Correct.
And fundamentalists tend to get off track and on the message, like perfecting it absolutely where there's no mistakes or errors whatsoever. And the good news is God uses people that are messed up, and even if you don't get the message precisely right, though we should strive to,
right,
God still uses that message to break through the hearts of sinners. Thankfully, he doesn't require that every I is crossed, or every I is dotted and T is crossed, before he works to save. That doesn't. I'm not encouraging sloppiness. You'll right. never hear
no,
me.
No. There's no.
I'm a precisionist.
There's no idea that we should be sloppy. But there's a difference in being precise and being overly critical in our precision.
Right.
So, John, any other thoughts that you want to share with us from being at the convention?
I think we had a pretty wide-ranging conversation already, and I like how you ended it, or your final comment there about missions, and that is fundamentally that's what our convention is about. That's why we were started as a mission sending group, with the acknowledgement that we can do more together than we can apart. We have great theological education in seminaries, world class. Theological education, and all of that is in service to the church and in the world. And I would say that remembering that as our focus, that we have marching orders from King Jesus to make disciples of all nations, that we have got to always, as a convention and as the individual churches that make up that convention, constantly be reminding ourselves that, so that all of that robust, deep theological thinking goes into hearts that are aflame with love for God and His glory, and that push us out into the world to share that with people that are going to hell apart from faith in Christ.
That's good. That's a good place for us to end. So we thank you for listening to this episode of Ordinary Fellowship, a podcast ministry of Two Rivers Community Church. For more information about Two Rivers, you can find it on our website at www.tworiverscc.org. We look forward to your questions, your comments, and even that dreaded hate mail at ordinaryfellowship@gmail.com. Please follow us on Facebook at Ordinary Fellowship and like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you listen to us on. But for now, we thank you for listening to this episode of Ordinary Fellowship, where we're striving to have spiritual conversations for practical Christian living.